that'll do it for the Breakfast Bar and Have You Heard. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. And the Surreal News, well, we're still going to be your weapon of mass instruction this morning. We have such a busy show. We're going to take that music right down here. And my guest, my co-host, is Lou Larini. I'm Steve Norris. And Lou is going to tell us, Lou, what's going on this morning?
Well, our first guest, and we're really glad to have her here in the studio with us, is Rana Bazzini, who is Sarasota's own Granny D. She has just returned from a march to Tallahassee to raise awareness of our broken campaign finance system. And I think we're going to start calling you Rana B.
Okay.
Like Granny D.
That's funny because that was the name of our boat.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's great. And later on in the show, we're going to have a gentleman called Dr. Paul Mahler, who has, you know, invented what may become the first flying car. And, you know, yeah, you heard me right. It is, in fact, a flying car. But before any of that, we are very lucky to have show favorite Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst, to come and talk to us about the recently released torture report by the Senate.
Yes, we have some breaking news about the torture report, and without further ado, we have Mel is very busy, and he's got about 10 minutes for us. Mel, what do we need to know here?
Well, I think the whole thing is surreal. There is John Brennan, the CIA director, in the lobby of the building yesterday holding a press conference, a televised press conference. I think that's unprecedented in the history of the CIA. And in that lobby, you know, the carving in there is from the Gospel of St. John. Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And, of course, Brennan's not talking about the truth in this case. He's calling the interrogators patriots. He refuses to use the word torture. He loves this Orwellian euphemism about enhanced interrogation techniques. The only CIA person who spoke out about torture and abuse is in jail. John Kiriakou is in jail in Pennsylvania. He received a 2.5-3 year sentence, while the people who conducted the torture, there are hundreds of them still working at the CIA. And when I read the report, and I've read it fully now, the executive summary, there's so much about it that it just fills you with disgust, all of this unconscionable activity. The rectal feeding, which is unbelievable to me, that the CIA called for medical reasons. Well, that was to get around the torture memos, because that's something that not even the torture memos allowed. And this is the reason why President Obama has made such a serious mistake. And he made it in his first week in office when he said, we're going to look forward and not backward. There are CIA people who went way beyond what even the torture memos allowed them to do. And they started this stuff even before the torture memos had been issued. And every aspect of it, the confinement in boxes, these are boxes that were 2.5 feet deep and 2.5 feet wide. Bugs were put into these things. Someone like Zubaida, who was a high-value target, who was talking when he was being interrogated, and then the CIA suddenly stopped and cut off all of the communication to throw him into a confinement box where he spent over 200 hours, nearly 2 weeks in one of these boxes. I mean, these are all the things, when you think of waterboarding and the rectal feeding and the confinement box, these were things that we took the Japanese to court for after World War II and called them war criminals. Yet you have Brennan saying, I'll leave it to others to decide how they want to label these activities. I mean, this is pathetic language, and I think what really topped it off for me today was looking at the New York Times, and there's an article in there that Obama today is going to sign a piece of legislation that was passed yesterday by the Congress that will place sanctions on Venezuelan officials who abuse the human rights of protesters in the capital of Venezuela, in Caracas. Now, that is surreal to me, given the fact that there's no court in this country that will handle any of these cases. And remember, a lot of these detainees were totally innocent. These were erroneous detainees, and we know from CIA records, and I think they're probably underestimating, but at least 26 people who were guilty of nothing were tortured and abused. And when you look at the way the program was handled, essentially it was turned over to two contractors who had worked at one time for the Air Force, who knew nothing about interrogation, nothing about the Middle East, nothing about Al-Qaeda. They formed a company and received more than $80 million to conduct this program. And by the end of this program, 85% of the people who were working on it were contractors. So this tells you something about CIA people. A lot of them, they produce no genuine whistleblowers, and they certainly didn't go public on any of this, but they didn't want to have anything to do with it either. So this is ugly stuff, and Brennan's final word from his press conference was, and I'm quoting almost exactly, "My fervent hope is that we can put aside this debate and move forward." Right. Let's just forget about the whole thing. Let's just pretend it never happened. Or as the former deputy director, John McLaughlin, who I've known for about 40 years, he said, reasonable men can disagree on these things. And well, this is a terrible passage, a terrible event in American history.
Yes, and a number of comments have said, well, you know, we had to interrogate these people because it's as if there was a bomb going off and we would have to get emergency information. Well, then why did they leave him alone in an isolated cell for 47 days and didn't even ask him any questions? I mean, and also they
exactly.
made it seem
and
like this
was... waterboarding
right?
was so effective, why was... KSL was waterboarded 183 times. Zubaydah was waterboarded 83 times. And these were patriots, we're told now, who conducted all of this activity.
Yeah, and then, you know, people say, of course, you know, the ends justify the means, but, you know, there's no clear evidence that any of this, and there's some debate, I don't know what the other side of the debate is, that there was actually some information here, but there's no evidence.
There's more than information. There's a great deal of evidence that makes it clear, and Senator Feinstein was tweeting during this press conference and basically defending her report while Brennan was lying to the press. There's tremendous evidence that the information we needed to get, we got without torture, and that torture and abuse added nothing to what we had. But really, the argument shouldn't be about whether torture and abuse produced anything that was effective. The debate should be about should we have been doing this in the first place. And it's clear that we shouldn't have been involved in this. There's one other thing that bothers me as someone who spent 24 years at the CIA and has now become a critic of the CIA. We're going through a phase now that is unprecedented in that the CIA has been totally politicized, because if you look at what's happening on the Hill, particularly in the Senate, this torture report was a Democratic report. It was written by Democratic staffers who work for Democratic senators, and Republicans had nothing to do with this report. So basically what you're saying is Democrats are willing to criticize the Central Intelligence Agency for their unconscionable deeds, and Republicans are going to continue to praise the CIA regardless of what they did. The only Republican has spoken out, and fortunately, it is John McCain, and there's no one in this country who has greater credibility in talking about torture and abuse than Senator John McCain. I may disagree with him about many of his political positions, but he's totally credible on torture and abuse, and basically he says it doesn't work. People lie, and we know that. Any agency that produces genuine interrogators, and the CIA really didn't have any, but if you look at the FBI and the military, General David Petraeus, who ran the CIA for a year, said the same thing. You know, you get good information through psychological techniques by co-opting people. If you use torture and abuse, you're going to get false information. People will say anything to stop the torture and abuse. So this is a sad period in American history.
All right, Mel, you've got about 50 seconds. What is your opinion about pardoning Cheney and Bush? And then give your website, and then I know you need to move on.
Well, the website is ciponline.org, and I'm now the national security columnist for counterpunch.org, so all of my writings are on Counterpunch. I can understand those who want to argue about a pardon, at least to establish for the record that crimes were committed, or else you wouldn't have to pardon people. But my problem with it is we still need greater accountability. We need some kind of truth and reconciliation committee, similar to what South Africa did after apartheid, or some East European regimes did after their police activities as part of the Soviet bloc. So I still would like to see that record made before any pardons are given. Clearly, these people are war criminals. They did the same things that the Japanese and Germans were put on trial for. So we need new leadership at the CIA. Brennan should be fired. People of real stature should be brought in. And I would go back to something we did in the 1970s after a period of CIA and FBI abuse in the COINTEL programs, and that is something like the Church Committee, which formed the intelligence committees in the first place. And now you have intelligence committees that are totally politicized. So this is a very difficult period.
All right, we'll let you go because I know you have many more interviews, and thank you for spending that time with us, and hopefully we can return.
It's always great
return.
To talk to you, Steve, and keep up the good work you're doing on these important issues.
Great. Okay, bye-bye now. All right, that was Mel Goodman. He's a former CIA analyst. He's the author of several books, and he's been on this show before and in town here. Former CIA. He has a lot of clout talking about what's going on with the torture report. We certainly could spend the whole hour on that. We're not going to, and some of that is in the news as well. Any comments, Lou, before we move on? And Rana, we have Rana Bazzani, Rana B. in the studio with us, too. And any comments by my co-hosts here?
No, but I'm glad that he brought up, and I couldn't agree with him more, that, John McCain's speech, on the Senate floor was quite appropriate, quite moving. And as John McCain pointed out, the reason why we should not do these things is not just because they're ineffective, but because that's not who we are. You know, there is a certain morality issue here, and when you think about what was actually done to these people, and for instance, just how big a 24.5-inch, a 30-inch by 30-inch box is.
Yeah.
And to put somebody in there for like 47 hours makes my, blood crawl and my knees hurt. It's just...
Yeah, the details are just very disturbing.
It is very disturbing that you're able to do that to another human being.
Check this out.
That just baffles me that somebody is able to do that.
If I can also add, some of the people who were actually ordered to do the torture themselves...
Yeah.
Well, some refuse, but some who did it themselves have traumatic stress from being forced to do things they knew were wrong. So some of the victims here are some of the... CIA agents and other people that actually did the torture and then later on said, we knew this was wrong, but we were just following orders. So in that case, prosecuting them is not the way. They suffered, some of them.
Absolutely.
Suffered through it too. You got to look who gave the orders. We're talking Cheney here.
Well, I mean, when you're forced to act like a sociopath and you don't happen to be a sociopath, it's got to have some repercussions on that, little check and balance we all hopefully possess called a conscience. Yes, you're absolutely right there. But, there's a lot to be said. We could kill, the whole day talking about this.
It's interesting that I know... progressive people, I'm just going to try, and then we'll try to move on, who are also sort of on the fence and say, maybe we should move on, and it doesn't do any good to pull back. And it's hard to talk to them about this because that virtually guarantees that this will happen again. And I think in order to move forward, we have to prosecute crimes. If not, then there's a precedent for doing it again, and then it will
That's
happen
right.
again.
That's right.
There's no question that if the Republicans get back in, the Democrats are out, Obama's not going to do that. But the Republicans get back in, this is just going to happen again.
Well, yeah. I mean, as a people, as a country, do we have any integrity at all? I mean, is it all just the ends justify the means?
That's right.
I mean, and that's what it's all about. I mean, and it just it just baffles me that people can make that argument. And as I said before, I mean, it really, when you read the details of this report, and also by the way, there was a guy on, and I hate to quote other news shows or sort of news shows, but there was a guy on the Jon Stewart show that said that while this report was like 538 pages, it was culled from something like 6 million pages of CIA stuff that contained like quote after quote after quote of actual guys who were there saying No, man, I can't do this.
All right, so we got to get it. We got to move on because
right,
we
yeah.
could just,
we,
yeah. you and I, I mean, we could go
we
on
could.
Like this. All right,
we
so could. Let's do a little bit of surreal news. We have Ronna B.,
yeah.
and then we have our flying
hey.
Car, Dr. Moeller. So tell me about
just,
eighth graders.
I just have
What's
to,
going
get,
on with
I
this
just have to
here?
Get this on.
Yeah.
This is, you know, yet another surreal thing from the Florida State Legislature. There is an effort, you know, there is a bill to require a controversial documentary in schools. Has gotten a House sponsor. An effort to require students in Florida public schools to watch the controversial documentary by conservative pundit Denise D'Souza gained ground this week with the support of a state House member. Rep. Neil Cumby, a Lakeland Republican, filed a bill seeking to mandate that all 8th and 11th grade students view the film America, Imagine the World Without Her. His legislation is identical to a measure filed by Senator Alan Hayes in November, an ultimatilla Republican, but it received heavy criticism that he was foisting propaganda on children when he announced his plan. But the legislation in just one chamber doesn't go very far. Not to say that the legislature should create objectives for schools, said Senate Education Committee Chairman John Legge, but how to get there and what to teach them is not something the legislature needs to engage in. Now, Peter Montgomery of the liberal advocacy group People for the American Way wrote about the proposal that it appears to be one of a kind in the nation and in the organizational blog, and he calls it a terrible idea. The movie is filled with, quote, offensive and inflammatory material that could cause a lot of problems in the classroom, Montgomery said, calling it a political diatribe aimed at hurting Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Among the things that are in the series, you know, D'Souza, of course, aims to discredit what he considers the philosophy of left-wing progressive democratic politics taught in schools. But I mean, among two of the issues, he argues, for instance, that American Indians couldn't adhere to treaties and were killing each other anyway, so that we didn't really cause genocide of the American Indians. And on the subject of slavery, he writes in his book of the same name, you know, did America owe something to the slaves whose labor have been stolen? Yes, he states, but that date has been best discharged through memory because the slaves are dead and their descendants are better off as a consequence of their ancestors being hauled from Africa to America.
Wow.
I mean, and he wants
let's
to show this
in schools.
Yeah, let's show this in schools. This is all very valid historical perspective.
Sounds like Koch brothers stuff that the Koch brothers are doing there.
Yeah, well, you know, Denise D'Souza.
All right, so the stories we're not going to get to today, just because we don't have enough time. Perry talking about you don't need to have any IQ to be run for president.
That's
we're
right.
not going to get to that
That's
one.
That's right.
Your Wisconsin fist story, we're not going to get to that one.
Oh, that guy was great. I mean, drunken driver, stopped for drunken driver and claimed, I wasn't drinking. I just ate a bunch of beer batter fish.
Right. The Grand Canyon story about trash.
That's right. Yeah, some guy who actually was fined $2,500 for dumping trash all along the Grand Canyon River.
Right.
And he was like some sort of guide.
And I'll just tell you my quick story that a guy drove his motorcycle down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and they were so angry at him, they made him take it apart and hike it back up piece by piece. That's true. And then your other story about ocean pollution.
Well, yeah, that
probably
is,
not
that
gonna
is,
get to that,
that
one
is
either.
Unfortunately, on the rise.
All right, let's just quickly do our Media Matters Minute, and we'll get to Ronna B. Don't touch that dial. We got a packed show
this
coming
is the Media
today.
Matters Minute. I'm Salvatore Cavallori. Right-wing media are relying on a litany of myths to defend the use of torture on terrorism suspects. At Media Matters, we've worked to dispel some of these myths. For example, on Fox's The Five, co-host Eric Bolling misleadingly argued that CIA techniques helped capture Bin Laden.
The CIA came forward and they aggressively interrogated some bad guys. And they got some intel that led to the capture of Osama Bin Laden.
But the truth, as ABC News explained, is the Senate report determined that, quote, the most valuable information on Osama bin Laden was obtained outside of enhanced interrogation techniques. On his radio show, Rush Limbaugh pushed the myth that the CIA didn't use torture.
The demonization of the CIA and their use of waterboarding is a textbook example of how the media and the rest of the Democrat Party establish a lie and repeat it until it becomes a fact. I'm going to tell you, torture isn't torture.
But the Senate report revealed techniques such as simulated drowning, freezing temperatures, and sleep deprivation were just some of the brutal methods employed by the CIA.
Oh, we love our Media Matters Minute.
Visit MediaMatters.org.
Yeah, Media Matters out of Washington, D.C., conservative misinformation, and they report it. We want to thank them, a nonprofit, for that. All right, you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. Our next guest is Ronna B. Ronna started out here in Sarasota with Jim Hightower, walking to Tallahassee, where she met Lawrence Lessig and David Cobb, trying to talk about how there's too much money influence in politics. And we want to invite back to the studio here. You're welcome back after your talk. You must be tired after all that walking there, Ronna.
You know, it's really funny. I'm not. And it feels like I just left yesterday. And I just said the mind and perception is a very, very strange thing, because I know I was gone 52 days. I know I walked 430 miles, but it doesn't feel like it. Yeah. It's really, it's bizarre. But I have to say quickly,
yes,
Mel Goodwin is one of my all-time heroes. I love that man, and I didn't realize he was going to be on. It was wonderful to hear him. And then what you guys were just talking about, I understand why you call it the surreal news.
Yes. So how about just sort of overall, what's sort of a couple of experiences that, I mean, there's so many there. What stands out in your mind? What is some of the most significant experience to you personally after walking from Sarasota to Tallahassee to try to tell people and shine a light on this issue?
Okay. I would have to say the one outstanding thing is the amount of support I got from people all across the board. And there was not one untoward incident during the whole walk.
Nice.
Not one.
Really? Nobody protested you?
There was no negative feedback. Of course, the people that would be doing that are the billionaires and millionaires, and I did not run across any of them on my walk. But truthfully,
maybe that's their protest by not showing up.
there you go. Well, like the Ray Claire Johnson, who was the kind of overall planner of the walk, and she made a great comment after the election, because we were all rather depressed about that, and she said, well, we did send a mandate. 70% of the people didn't vote. What does that tell you? We're not happy with anybody, and yet it was the most expensive election ever.
Yeah.
So this all fed into the purpose of
the walk. And Ron, in the bill that was passed last night, there's a provision increasing the amount that people can spend to $1.5 million.
Yeah,
is our stopgap bill, making things worse, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the, again, positive things is that we are hearing from people like Elizabeth Warren. If you got her speech yesterday, it was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. I mean, she really lays it out. And number one, she's very credible because she's extremely bright and she knows her subject. She knows
absolutely.
It upside down and backwards. And her speech, she's not a rabble-rouser. She kind of believes in the same thing I do, I think. Or I believe in the same thing she does. I should probably put it that way. And it was one of the primary focuses of my walk is not to be confrontational, because you cannot get anywhere if you set up a barrier, you know, with the people with whom you want to work. And that
yes.
was one of the highlights of my walk, when I met with Jimmy T. Smith, who is the Florida rep from the Inverness area. We could not be more opposite as far as political philosophy is concerned. And one of the things that I made a point of doing whenever I was going to meet with someone, whether they were a politician or someone in the media, was to kind of, and this is where, because you know me, I'm kind of anti-tech, but this is where I loved Google. I would kind of Google them and find out some information about them. And when I Googled Jimmy T. Smith, I saw that he had dropped out of school and he'd gotten a GED. And I thought, well, I'm going to check his website to see if he has that on, that, you know, because he might not want people to know that. And he also served in the Army for 20 years. And his birthday was a day before my son's, a different year, but the day was. So there was kind of a little human contact. And my focus, because I have never met anyone that I could not find a point on which we could agree or some human connection. Now, I've never met Hitler or Mussolini or people like that. But the people that I have had personal contact with, I've never been able to not find a human connect. And this was with Jimmy. Now, the woman that was going with me, she said, I don't want to go in his office. I had a very unpleasant confrontation with him, and I just don't want to be there. And I said, well, come with me, because I don't want to go in alone. I would like to have somebody with me. And I said, besides, he's a politician. He's not going to remember. And she did come in with me, but she did, true to her word, she didn't say a word. So we're expecting to maybe have a 15-20 minute, you know, meeting. And I brought up the fact that I, you know, I admired anybody that went back and got themselves educated. My niece had done the same thing. And that kind of softened, you know, the thing. And I also mentioned about the birthday. I said, oh, anybody born in October has to have good points. And yeah, so we got a couple of laughs and whatever. And we started to talk. And when he got up and said that, well, you know, he really had another appointment, whatever, we had talked for 2 hours.
Wow.
It was incredible. A lot of things we didn't agree on, but we could have a civilized conversation. And we shook our hands. Actually, we hugged each other and said that, you know, we can agree to disagree, but we don't have to be disagreeable. And when we left, Andrea, who was with me, she said, you know, I wish I had videotaped that, because this is the way people who disagree should relate to one another.
Indeed.
And we did find the one thing on my issue. He believed in transparency. He said, as long as we're going to have money, which you have to have. I mean, you let's be not naive. You have to have some amount of money when you're running for office. But it should be transparent. We should know where the money comes from. So we had that one point of agree. But that was one of the highlights, because you can open the gate to people that don't agree with you so that you can work with them. And I'm just adamant about that.
And once again, we're talking to the Rana B, who did walk from Sarasota area to Tallahassee to talk about money and politics. And she's back here in town talking about now her the last few days. So we followed you along your trips.
Yes.
Tell us again a little bit more about those last few days and then the final days of your walk.
Okay. First of all, my nightmare was that nobody would show up. Because I had this wonderful group of people that were coming up. John Boniface, who is probably the most endearing person I've ever met in my life. He's for he's the head of speech for Free Speech for People. And Lawrence Lessig, who is another one of my idols. And I actually felt like a Bobby Soxer meeting Frank Sinatra when I got to meet Lawrence Lessig, because I really, really admire that man.
Us too.
Yeah, oh, good. And the funny thing about, because I've seen him on television a lot, and I had the impression he was rather short. Well, I think he's close to 6 feet tall, which gave us a shock, because I expected him not to be much taller than I. And we had a chance, because he walked the last 5 miles into Tallahassee on Wednesday, nice. December the 3rd. So we had a chance to really, really talk. And, you know, and David Cobb also, and John, and the three of them, who are such powerhouses, very different individuals. They're kind of approaching this from different angles, but they're working together. And they're just, they're wonderful people. David, I got the biggest kick out of, because I listened to his speaking, I think, 3 or 4 times. And every time I'm fascinated. And he mentioned that his dad was, or his grandfather, had been a Baptist minister. And it was so funny, because he comes across as, I mean, he's so dynamic that it seems like you're listening to a revival, you know, tent revival, something like that. He's a great, great speaker, and so much knowledge. And so I had these people coming, and I thought, oh, suppose nobody shows up. Well, wonderful, wonderful. Arlene, bless her, she's an amazing person. Arlene Sweeting from here, you guys all know. And she organized, and Jamie Canfield, the two of them, and Kendra Muntz from Venice, and they all put together the bus that came up, so there were a bunch of people that I recognized, and it was so good to see them. And then people from Tallahassee. There was this one woman, her name is Lakey, and she's a PhD candidate and an instructor at Florida State up in Tallahassee. And more about her later if we have time, because she's connected to the next project. I heard you mention Coke before.
Yes.
That's going to be something else that's coming down the line. Anyway, so a bunch of people showed up. We filled the steps on the old Capitol building, and the crowd was just so enthusiastic and so supportive. And the speakers, David, John, and Lawrence, and Lakey, and I can't remember if someone else spoke, but they all spoke, and they were just so powerful, and everybody loved them. They got great reception. We also got pretty good coverage from the media. There were like five or six microphones. I really don't know which, you know, who it was there.
Right.
But we got coverage on radio, on television, and the newspapers. So that was really, really good. And so it, my nightmare of nobody showing up, thank goodness, did not come to pass. And we had a great crowd. We ended it by having a potluck at the UU Church there and a performance of Go Granny D by Barbara Bates Smith and Jeff Siebens, which also was incredibly well received. The night before, we had a showing of Pay to Play and a panel discussion afterwards. So it was 2 days filled with activity and wonderful, wonderful energy from all the people who appeared.
Well, it's terrific. Could you, like, briefly tell us what's coming up next for Ron?
Yeah, well, this is kind of funny. This is Ray Clare, and I have to say that woman's mind never stops. She's constantly thinking. And the Friday before, I think it was November 29th, we met with Lakey, the young woman I told you about before from Florida State. And she was telling us, she's an activist and just chapter and verse knows her research. And she got a hold of a memo that talked about the contract between the Koch brothers and Florida State.
Uh-huh.
Where,
yeah.
Have you heard about it?
Yeah, I've heard about
okay.
it. Okay. Yeah.
So the two issues are so connected between taking over our education system and also taking over our government. I mean, they're like Siamese twins.
That's right.
Yeah, so Ray Clare announces, before she even had a chance to discuss it with me, that we're going to go on tour the college campuses after the holidays. Now, this has to be put together, because I'm not going to do anything unless we've got it logistically planned and, you know, I know what I'm doing.
Sounds terrific, but Steve has given me the sign that we've got somebody on the phone, and you know what? I'm really glad that you're doing something else,
okay,
because that gives us an excuse to get you back on again. Yeah. Tell us about that when that all gets nailed down.
Okay. Yes, yes.
Yeah, well, it's not a problem, because you know what my son said. The problem with me is making me stop talking.
Okay. Well,
I'd apparently stop walking, too.
thank you again, Rana, for joining us here in the studio.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
And please stay while we talk to Dr. Paul Mahler.
Let me just remind everybody, you're listening to WSLR 96.5. We're LP FM in Sarasota, Florida. We are your true community radio station right here in Sarasota, Florida. And this is the Surreal News, your weapon of mass instruction. I'm Steve Norris, and Lou Larini is my co-host, and he's going to introduce our next fabulous guest.
Yes, we are fortunate to have from California Dr. Paul Mahler, who is, you know, this is a very brief bio, but he is the inventor of SkyCar, a VTOL light aircraft that has the potential to become the first personal use aircraft, a flying car, as it were, to be used. Welcome, Dr. Mahler. Thanks for coming.
Good morning.
Yeah. I understand, you know, there's like lots of things that I can say about you, but I found this, like, particularly impressive that you're one of the few people in the world to hold both a master's and a doctorate degree in various engineering disciplines without ever going to undergraduate school.
Well, yes, I chose to go to a trade school instead and become a machinist and welder and whatever else it takes to build airplanes, because I was not a particularly good student in high school, or let's just say I didn't like high school very much. So going off and getting those manual skills was important to me, and through the good fortune of meeting the right person, I was able to get into graduate school later on.
That's great, you know, and I guess while we're talking about the past, you know, a little bit, isn't there, didn't you get the idea, you know, for sort of the general concept of this flying car from something you saw when you were just a boy?
Yes, really the first experience with V2L, which is the characteristic of aircraft, is, makes it different from other so-called flying cars, meaning that it can take off and land vertically, was, of course, the Hummingbird when I was very young in a, on the side of a rural area of a mountain in Canada where my father was a chicken farmer. And I saw this impressive capability to get around. And, of course, as a kid trying to get to school, that was a pretty exciting option. And what we have in common with the Hummingbird is it has a very high power-to-weight ratio, which is, means that we have a lot of power. We need a lot of power to take off vertically. That's exactly sort of a mechanical replication of the Hummingbird was our, was my goal through the years.
Well, that's really interesting. And now, you know, I know this probably isn't entirely accurate, but I'm a big fan of the movie Blade Runner, and and I couldn't help but think when I saw the pictures of the sky car that it does in fact resemble, you know, the vehicles in that movie. I mean, just to give our listeners sort of, I guess, a point of reference, is that kind of right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's very much like the, well, what we'd like to do is do things similar to the Blade Runner Fifth Element, have ability to fly pretty much like we operate on the ground, but for that part of the world, not necessarily in the city. There's not a lot of logic of moving around the city with this kind of device, at least initially. It's very fast, and the advantage is, of course, it's roughly 10 times faster than the average speed of an automobile on the highway in America today. So that would take you from spending equivalent to something like 14 hours of our life behind the wheel of a car to something like, you know, 1.5 years, which would be a saving of a good deal of one's lifespan.
Yeah, let's actually, while we're on sort of the specs of the sky car, you know, let's talk a little bit more about that specifically. Like for instance, what is the cruising speed of sky car, or would be?
Well, it varies, of course, according to altitude. That's a part of the nature of aeronautics. At sea level, its best cruising speed is a couple of hundred miles an hour. At 25,000 feet, where it would be pressurized, it would be a good cruise speed with 300 miles an hour. It'd go a lot faster than that, but it would also burn in a lot of fuel when it did so.
Yeah, and that's another interesting question, you know, about how... you know, you get into logistics of things, you know, we're all interested in fuel economy. How economical is it? I mean, how many miles to the gallon, I guess, if that's even a right measure, would such a thing get?
Well, it's one of the advantages, this utilitarian advantage, and we always have a criteria that we aim for, which is 100 passenger miles per gallon. That's about as good as the very, very best airplane you can get today. And I'm talking about a smaller airplane. The big, powerful jet planes carrying a load of passengers can get more than 100 passenger miles per gallon. But our goal is 100 passenger miles per gallon, and we're very close to that at this time. Meaning that if you have a one-passenger Skycar 100, you'd get 100 miles per gallon. If it was a two-passenger, you'd get 50. And if it was a four-passenger, you'd get 25. But the important thing is that you'd, if you're renting this vehicle, which I think is what's going to start off that way, you'd rent a vehicle consistent with your passenger load, so you wouldn't be running around with a five-passenger car with one person in it.
Okay, yeah, that actually brings up another, you know, like really interesting question that I'd really like you to like describe for our listeners. You know, what sort of the future would look like? I know there's a lot of things that have to happen, you know, before we will actually have flying cars, and that the economical and practical design of the actual vehicle itself is just the beginning. You know, what about hits? What about, you know, how these things would be, regulated? I mean, you can't have people taking off and flying all together.
Well, certainly at the beginning, you'd have a pilot's license, because although, quite frankly, if we get it classified under a category, an FAA category, similar to the light sports aviation, you would not need a pilot's license. Even for the beginning, you would need what's called a pilot certificate, which means basically ground school. But when there's any numbers of these vehicles flying, clearly it has to be very ordered. And that is underway, called Highway in the Sky. It's a virtual highway system. Obviously not very complicated if you think about it, because we already have it in place today. All the passenger planes are flying around on it, but they're primarily using it for most of the time above 25,000 feet. We just have to keep bringing that highway system down into the area where we would be using it, and you just drive this vehicle, the sky car, from your home to a vertiport, code in your destination, and take it there. In fact, you would not be able to take over the controls during a flight. This is essential for everybody else's safety.
Okay, isn't too though? You know, one of the things that.
I'm sorry, I'm losing your voice a little here.
Okay, all right. Can you hear me now?
Yes, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't it true that perhaps in the beginning the first incarnation of these flying cars is going to be actually a flying taxi service, that that you're not really gonna, it's not really going to be people driving them from their garage and owning one. You're just going to rent it like a taxi.
Absolutely, the majority, although I don't want to discourage anybody from the concept of owning it. Certainly, many people could afford it, and as the volume goes up, the price will go down, and at some point in time, it would be available to a large part of the population. But the question would be, is that logical to own it when, in fact, you can rent it at a very reasonable price when you need it? It would deliver itself to your home. So you don't have people involved in that program that lands in your front yard and you walk out there and take off, or perhaps not exactly your front yard, but very close to your home in a landing pad, and you would go from there. Yes, I think that's the majority use of it for probably into the distant future, but people who want to own it could certainly do so.
You know, but what that would essentially do then, I mean, if I understand you correctly, just to, sort of crystallize this vision in our listeners' minds, is that, if you had like a 100-mile commute to work, you could basically get there in, 20 minutes,
Oh, yeah, a lot faster than that.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
It would be very convenient, and actually it could be all dropped off there and somebody else could pick it up there and take it someplace else. I mean, it is not a big vehicle. If you're going using it for something like getting to work, you'd use a one-passenger vehicle, which is not a lot bigger than a motorcycle. So you could certainly reduce traffic in the city at some point if you're commuting in and out of the city, or perhaps a lot of people will move from the city to a more convenient place and commute into the city just because they would like that lifestyle.
You know, that's another point that I wanted to bring up. Like, obviously the advent of, the internal combustion engine and affordable automobiles, basically created the thing we call the suburbs now, because before that, it just wasn't practical for you, to have, your little cobbler shop or, your blacksmith shop in town and not live in town. You couldn't live out on a farm, 25, 30 miles outside of town, because it took you half a day to get to work, right?
Right.
And so what that's going to do is, I think it's going to make a lot more of this land, that's, not being used now because it's not around, centers of production or places where people, can have jobs, more usable. I mean, I don't want to take up your time, but I mean, I know I'm from New England. I'm from Massachusetts. People visualize and think that like Massachusetts is this packed state, that it's like really densely populated. Well, it is on the coast. It is around Boston and down like the coastal corridor all the way down to New York. But you get into like central Connecticut and central Massachusetts, and it's like wide open. You might as well be in the middle of nowhere, right?
Right.
And all those areas would then become more habitable, I guess.
Yes, it would change the demographics of much of the things we, the way we live, in a very convenient way. And of course, you know, if I wasn't developing this vehicle, someone else would, or someone else already is developing similar vehicles. The thing that makes our vehicle possible is, as I mentioned earlier, the ability to generate a huge amount of power. And so what our contribution brings to this field is this. It wasn't our intention to necessarily become engine designers, but out of desperation, so to speak, we had to develop an engine that generated more power than any engine had ever generated of this style to be able to make this happen. And fortunately, it's got its own life now, and we have roughly $5 billion in conditional orders for the engine for other applications.
Wow. Yeah,
so we're going to become as much an engine company, I suppose, which is good because economy of scale is important. If you're producing large numbers of engines, which is the most expensive component by far in the vehicle, primarily because you have so much horsepower, then the vehicle itself becomes cheap. So it's a very synergistic activity, both very much helping the other economics.
Yeah, aren't these engines working on, you know, the rotary engine, I guess, you know, invented by a fellow named Wankel?
Dr. Felix Wankel, a genius who I admire greatly, and quite frankly, I owe my future involving in the sky car to Dr. Wankel, because quite frankly, if he had not invented the rotary engine, I would not have a sky car.
You know, and you know, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, Mazda, I don't think the, you know, the Mazda first sports car model that they put out that had a Wankel engine in it. I don't know if they still use a Wankel engine in that, do they?
No, they've discontinued the use of it. They do have a fleet of them driving with hydrogen because the rotary engine works very well with all fuels, including hydrogen. So if hydrogen comes into the future, I'm sure that the automobile will have a rotary engine in it. But we took that basic principle of Wankel's and made it very light and very powerful. And that's the difference between us and, say, the engine in the Mazda, which is quite not, it's still very light relative to a normal piston engine, but weighs, you know, 3 or 4 times more than our engine for the same power.
Yeah, what's kind of the horsepower of, you know, one of your engines?
We have a 200 and some horsepower engine that you can tuck under your arm.
Wow.
Or, you know, a 50 horsepower engine you can hold in the palm of your hand.
Wow.
And it burns any kind of fuel. It's very mission-free. When I say that, nothing's perfectly mission-free, but according to California Resources Board, it's the lowest emissions they've measured.
Yeah, it burns pretty hot, and it burns everything pretty much completely,
that's,
right?
That's
yeah.
Right. It does that.
So, you know, and just, you know, for our listeners who aren't motorheads, I'm not really one either, but I am interested in engineering. You know, when you talk about a rotary engine, most people think of an internal combustion engine with, you know, a camshaft and pistons that go up and down and cylinders. Isn't sort of the whole thing about the rotary engine is it spins around. It uses that same internal combustion, you know, principle, but the pistons, it creates its energy in a more circular way. It's not pistons going up and down. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, the thing that's impressive about the rotary engine is that it has only two moving parts. Even a two-stroke has three, and a four-stroke equivalent, a four-stroke would have 35. So, and I'm talking about moving parts.
Wow.
If you've got a few other stationary parts, but those are the critical elements. So, you know, God bless Felix Wankel. I wish that I had the opportunity to meet him before he passed. But it's a genius design. Absolutely, I swear, if the rotary engine had been invented in 1900, you'd never have seen a piston engine.
That's true. I just want to remind our listeners that this is WSLR 96.5 FM, and we are speaking to Dr. Paul Mahler, the inventor of SkyCar. You know, these engines now, you know, I noticed in, you know, the, you know, picture, and as a matter of fact, rather than post a picture of you, Dr. Mahler, on our blog when I was sort of promoing this show, you know, I thought I'd do the picture of the car. So I hope you aren't you know, upset with me for doing that, because the car, I think, I mean, you're a good-looking guy and everything, but the car is just like really interesting to look at. You know, but you know, I noticed it looks like it's got like, you know, four engines.
It's got four lifting nacelles. Yeah. Each nacelle has two engines, so right. It has eight engines. That's key to our design, too. Our driving force, or my driving force at the very beginning, which became our driving force, was to build something that was very, very safe. And so we have multiple engines. They all operate with a central computer, but the idea is that one engine can fail and it won't be catastrophic. And we have multiple computers. We have four computers talking to each other. If one of those computers doesn't agree with the other three, it gets kicked out. And that's essential because you know everything is going to fail sometime in your lifetime, and you want to make sure that that failure is not does not have consequences.
You know, that is absolutely right, and that's something that I guess always occurred to me whimsically, you know, about flying cars. Unlike regular cars, you know, you can get a blowout and just basically, you know, glide to a stop on the corner, you know, on the side of the road, on the shoulder. But I guess if you get the analogous calamity as a blowout in a flying car, you know, you got to think quick. So
well,
it's nice. It's nice.
The computer has to think quick, which is what it's designed to do. It takes over and automatically within milliseconds speeds up the appropriate engines to take over for the one that failed. We wouldn't even know if we didn't have a light come on the dash. We didn't even know we lost an engine or a computer.
Wow.
It's
okay.
Automatic.
And yeah. So I mean, I guess those kinds of redundancies, you know, needed to be part of the design, you know, for safety. What about flying this thing? I mean, I read in one article. I mean, I guess you've tested this. You've like flown this thing, right?
Right. We've flown different models. If you watch some of the alien programs on television, they show for a period of about 2 or 3 seconds one of my first aircraft I flew back in the 60s. And, of course, with the implications that it's a flying saucer because it was much more of a saucer-shaping aircraft. But we've been flying different models, evolving just as engines evolved, because the engine is so critical, it really drives the design. And, of course, you know what the one today, you see a streamlined aircraft because it has enough power to fly very fast, and therefore aerodynamics is important. It's an evolutionary process governed by power and materials and avionics. As I said, our responsibility turns out to be primarily the engine and its incredible capabilities, but we're very dependent on carbon fiber, much stronger than steel and lighter than magnesium, and avionics today is very, very inexpensive, and that's important as well.
Yeah, okay. That sounds right. You know, we talked briefly, you know, about the engines, and you do have basically two companies connected to this. I mean, I just want to let people make sure people know that you aren't just, you know, some guy tinkering in his garage. Haven't you raised close to $100 million for this project?
Well, in today's dollars, we've raised over $200 million, and probably more importantly, we've acquired all of the rotary assets from every other major American company that was in the rotary engine business, who decided that they weren't going forward with it because they really hadn't found the perfect project for that engine, which is something like the Sky Car. And so we acquired all the rotary engine assets of General Motors, Outboard Marine Corporation, Inchinet, Infinite Engine Company, Curtis Wright, John Deere. And that really gives us this technical capability, in addition to, quite frankly, spending about $40 million on engines ourselves. But what we've done is, yes, we spun off a different company called Freedom Motors, which is about to become a public company in the next perhaps 60 days. And it will carry on with the engine, building engines for us and the rest of the world.
And what are the other applications for these very, very light and very, very powerful engines?
Well, one of the ones, we just completed a project for a Singapore company who has given us a conditional order for 1 million engines and a firm order for quite a large number of engines, is for a motor scooter. And we put our engine in this motor scooter, and you can hardly find the engine. It's smaller than the transmission. You'd think it was a starter motor. Very light, very efficient, but most important, no vibration. So that was, I think, the value added was primarily in reducing vibration. But where I think the future is going to be much bigger is in the hybrid car, because we can take, if you buy a Volt hybrid car today, the engine is as big as it used to be, plus you have all the other things. you can take RNAs and you can't exactly hide it in the gum compartment, but you can get it into a very small, you can get it into less than a cubic foot versus something that's in the area about 9 cubic feet today. And that means you save weight, you are very efficient, you have no vibration. There's many things that make this attractive for the hybrid car.
Well, yeah, I mean, anybody in common with even slightest bit of common sense or, I guess, mechanical knowledge, I guess, would understand that, that weight-to-power distribution is, or ratio, is critical to fuel efficiency. You know, I mean, it takes a certain amount of fuel, I guess, to move a certain poundage forward, and if you can reduce the poundage, and I guess you reduce the amount of fuel that you need. So, you know, I could see that whole engine thing, you know, even without SkyCar being
right. You're absolutely right. We know that if we can't fund the SkyCar, which has always been a problem for us, is raise enough money to move from our demonstration vehicles into production aircraft. We will use the engine as our springboard to bring the SkyCar into everybody's use, because the engine is something that that really can't be replaced. There is not any alternatives, at least at the moment, to what we have.
Is it one of the things holding back, I guess financial interest in SkyCar, the fact that HITS, that highway system hasn't been devised yet or I guess approved yet? I mean, isn't that a governmental thing, sort of like the FAA, but sort of different?
Yeah, and of course, people have been promised a flying car, which is kind of a misnomer, because what our vehicle is a roadable aircraft. It's primarily a good aircraft. It's a acceptable road vehicle for slow speeds, relatively speaking, 30 miles an hour. We could build a vehicle to go out on the highway, but it would compromise the overall performance of both that and the aircraft, so that nobody'd really have it as a practical use. So it's a critical point that it's a good aircraft and it's capable of getting you around in the city, which is important.
Yeah, that would be important because, obviously, too, I mean, just as a matter of practicality, you can't have these things taken off, just anywhere willy-nilly, because you don't have, the vision to know whether somebody is taken off, like, right next to you, I guess, and that could cause problems. So, I mean, as you described earlier, that, the way this most likely will work is, you'd sort of motor to some heliport near where you lived, if you owned one, say, and take off from there when you were cleared by, I'm assuming, some sort of central group that I guess could be connected to the computers in the car?
Yes, we use GPS primarily, but GPS is only accurate within, a few, 10, 20 feet. And then they use differential GPS, which could be any number of local towers that allow you to get control within inches. So between those two, and of course they're both redundant because we have GPS, we have GLONASS in Russia, we have Galileo in Europe. So we have redundant systems that we would use so that even if that system went out, we'd still be okay. And we also have the inertial guidance system that was used for years. It'll take the aircraft down if you don't have any electronics. It'll just land you automatically.
Okay. One final question, and just really quickly, are there any plans for, a public demonstration of this vehicle? Because I'm sure it would be all over TV.
Well, in fact, we have somewhere between 750 and 1,000 press people who have signed out to attend a press flight. But we've always been delayed on that because we want to get in a lot of flight time. Clearly, that would be a very risky thing for us to do without a lot of experience. And so even though we've flown these aircraft a number of times, we've never really taken the SkyCar to its full flight mode. clearly because we don't have the capital to do all that flight testing that we feel is necessary. And so I cannot say when we will demonstrate it, but I expect it'll be in late 2015 at the worst, and probably early on. We've got programs going right now that would like make that possible. But I've made promises in the past that it was going to happen quicker than we were able to deliver on, so I'm cautious about giving a specific time. It's there. The technology's there. The vehicle is viable today. The highway and the system and the sky is coming. We're in a mode of the evolution of transportation that says that this is going to happen. Whether we did it or not, other people will do it. It's possible.
That is very exciting, Dr. Mahler, but we are running out of time. I really want to thank you for getting up early and joining us here, because I know you are on the coast.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention one thing. We are a public company, as you mentioned, or maybe didn't know that, so that people can go
Freedom,
to our
that's
website
right.
And click yeah. on invest and become part of the company if they want to.
That would be tremendous. Thank you again. I just want to remind our listeners, this is WSLR 96.5 FM, and we were just speaking to Dr. Paul Mahler, the inventor of SkyCar. Bye now.
Good night. Thank you.
All right, pretty interesting. We went up in the air with the sky car.
That is, like, really interesting. I don't know what's more interesting, the sky car. I'll tell you what, you know, I'm not really much of a motorhead, but I do appreciate great engineering. And what he was telling me about that engine, you know, an engine, you know,
cool.
a 50-horsepower engine you can tuck underneath your arm. I'm holding your hand.
I know.
I mean, that just blows my mind. I mean, that's amazing.
All right, the news and views you hear are not those of WSLR. It's board members, volunteers, employees, or anyone else. Just to the people that gave them, take what you like and leave the rest. I also want to thank Rana B for coming back and talking to us. And, of course, Mel Goodman. And after this show, we have Complex Waveforms with Mark Zampella, which is coming up. If you missed any parts of this show, go to thesurrealnews.com to hear our podcast. We're also live streaming at WSLR.org. And, of course, on 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. That's where the radio. This is The Surreal News Show, your weapon of mass instruction. Have a great day. And here comes some music with Mark Zampella.